No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to all of us. And today, I have a very special guest. I'm honored to have Senator Ben Nelson from the state of Nebraska. Senator Nelson served two terms as in the United States Senate from 2001 to 2013. During his tenure, he earned a reputation as a moderate who was adept at bringing colleagues on both sides of the aisle together to find compromise on some of the biggest issues facing our country. And if that weren't enough, Senator Nelson was also the governor of the state of Nebraska. So it's great to have somebody with this much political experience on, especially a good Democrat, as I've been a Democrat since I can remember, I think since birth. But welcome, Senator Nelson. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Senator. It's a privilege to be on your show, and I'm certainly looking forward to it. And it's an opportunity to talk about a lot of issues that are important today that sometimes aren't getting the attention they need, and some that maybe are getting a little bit more attention than they deserve.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I'm anxious to hear what those are in your opinion. But first, let me tell you that I recently, like last month, I went to Nebraska, late March, I think. I was in Nebraska. It was 65 degrees. It was beautiful in Lincoln. But I went to testify before the Senate on a resolution supporting D.C. statehood. And I must tell you, I was just floored by Lincoln, Nebraska. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's really clean. And your Capitol building, I don't think I, with the exception of perhaps the Capitol building here in Washington, I'm not sure I've ever seen a prettier Capitol building than the one in Lincoln. It's just amazing. And the people are really, really nice. Senator, it must have been a great place to be a representative because, yeah, I stayed at the Cornhusker, of course.
Sure.
I didn't meet one person I didn't like. So let me start there by asking you, when Donald Trump got elected, I said it couldn't happen. Everybody asked me in 2016, I said, don't be ridiculous. Nobody's going to elect this guy. And I had a friend from Arizona say, you live in a bubble, Michael. You live in a bubble there in Washington. So you just don't get it. And ever since he got elected, I paid attention to that. And I think she was right. I think we do live in a bubble here on the East Coast. So tell me about Nebraska. What is it that we don't get as Democrats about the state of Nebraska, especially with somebody that had such a distinguished career as a Democrat in a basically Republican state? What don't we get here in Washington, do you think?
Well, I think that there's a disconnect in Washington, D.C. may not be the only location where this might be true as well, in my opinion. But balanced budget. Nebraska, when I was governor, I had 8 balanced budgets in a row because I was required to by our state constitution. And some people will say it's well because it was a law. I was also teased by my staff as being as tight as three coats of paint, making sure that whatever we spent was well spent and on our priorities. I think that in certain areas, there's not the same intensity for balancing a budget and not spending money that you don't have and borrowing into the future. We didn't even borrow money for highway construction. Now there are some bonds that are being let in some of the communities and what have you. But it was it's a pay-as-you-go society, because I think that's the way everybody has been brought up in their family, whether they're Democrats, Republicans, or Independents, or non-aligned.
Yeah, and that's a basic American value, isn't it? I mean,
isn't it?
I mean, sometimes we have to deficit spend, but and on an individual basis, we all do a lot of it. But yeah, that's what we teach our children, right? Don't spend money
exactly.
that you don't have, right? Have a savings account. You know, I'm proud to say that a friend of mine, unfortunately, passed away and left a retirement account to my daughter, who's 31, mm-hmm. and she used the account to open a retirement account for herself and her younger brother and her younger sister. So, mm-hmm. which flabbergasted me. I said, "What a great idea to you know," because I'm afraid when I was 30 years old, if somebody had left me some money, I would have gone out and bought a new car. But sure. you know, I'm glad that she has that value, and that's what we try to teach all our kids, right? Is there something that's changed in Nebraska? I don't know. I'm sorry that I didn't do the research to see how many Democrats are still elected in Nebraska, but we see it as a solid red state. And is there something that Democrats have to learn besides balancing the budget? Senator, I was lucky to travel. Go to every state in the continental United States when I was 18 years old. I took my Ford Pinto. I slept in it. I was gone for 4 months. I spent $800, which I still can't believe. And and I got to meet the people of America. And I think this is why I love the country so much, because it's such a beautiful place and the people are so wonderful. But I think I guess what I'm trying to say, Senator, is we've become so partisan,
yeah.
And there's such a big divide. Is there a way we can get over that you see?
We have to get over it. If we're going to have a United States of America as opposed to a developing, divided States of America, that not only don't split down party lines, but split down the lines sometimes on social issues and other issues. So we have to find a way to come together. That doesn't mean that we're going to have the same view on every issue, but we have to have real understanding that the rights of the minority deserve representation as well. For example, in Nebraska, in the state of Maine, we are a state, while I was governor, we got this legislation through to divide our electoral votes that are based on the number of congressional districts that there are. So it's based on population differences in locations. And so Nebraska has, on two occasions, split the electoral votes so that one vote has gone to the Democratic candidate and two for president and two presidential elections. And that's now entitled our state to be called the second congressional district, which includes mostly Omaha and Douglas County, that is now called the Blue Dot. That's a recognition that the rights of the minority within a state can have an opportunity to be recognized in this manner. Now, it's a partisan issue for some Republicans who've been trying to repeal it ever since we got it through, and they haven't been able to do that yet. But the recognition is that when it was passed, the Republican majority was not as significant as it is today, because I had just been elected governor and got reelected as a governor and reelected to the United States Senate. That hasn't happened since I left office.
Well, it's really becoming, you're really hearing people talk more and more about this, right? About getting rid of the Electoral College altogether and just going on a popular vote. And we know that it was the Senate that came up with the idea to begin with. But yeah, there's certainly momentum in that direction. And am I right that you are the only unicameral legislation in the United States? Are you unicameral state?
Yes, we are. Nebraska is the only unicameral, and it's officially nonpartisan as well. Now, unfortunately, it has developed its own level of partisanship over the last four governors, Republican governors, have pushed partisanship ahead of what I consider to be citizenship, and for the sake of getting people elected to the Senate, trying to create a partisan legislature where it functions so much better as a nonpartisan, independent type of operation without party caucuses and the like. I never had a partisan caucus while I was governor. I appointed 11 members to the Senate because of departures of some unfortunate deaths and some resignations and retirements midterm. And 11 out of 49. And I didn't determine who was a partisan, who was a Democrat or who was a Republican. And I had the opportunity at the time to make it partisan on the 49th appointment to make it. And I appointed a Republican. I didn't get criticized by the Democrats, and I didn't get praised by the Republicans. It was just the way that it should be handled. I made a decision based on who I thought was the best candidate to replace the departed member.
I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine in this day, in this environment, Senator, that we can do that anymore. I hope we can in some instances. And when we wrote our Constitution, I helped write a Constitution, which is a requirement for statehood. We're trying to become a state. And we looked, because we have a unicameral, we set up a unicameral legislature, and we looked very closely at Nebraska, and we're very, very impressed at how well. I think we were surprised even to see how well it all works. But let me ask you about a specific issue. Let's talk about specific issues. Now, I assume that, like most Western states, the Second Amendment is important to the people of Nebraska. And we have a real gun problem here in Washington. And there are many of us that want to find some equilibrium, but we don't seem to know how to do it. You know, we have the gun people on the one hand that seem to want any gun you can buy, and the other people against that are opposed to gun control people on the other side saying no guns, no guns, no guns. So is there a way to reach a happy medium, you think, in Nebraska? You think Nebraska people are for an assault weapons ban or background checks or licenses, or does that go too far with them?
Well, I can only speak from my own experience and from as a hunter, knowing other of my colleagues, friends who have hunted with and I continue to hunt with, that there's an appreciation of guns for in their place. I don't see a lot of people arguing for automatic weapons or semi-automatic weapons other than those who say no requirements for right. guns. I would have to say the most extreme position, no limitations whatsoever. Most people you talk to raise serious doubts about whether there's a necessity for these weapons. Yeah. On the other hand, I know many who have them and have no ill use in mind for them. They just enjoy shooting and target practice or whatever. And what you really do need to try to identify is how to quantify by grouping, maybe in part by guns, but not so much by guns, as to try to find people who are more likely than not to misuse or who have misused guns as weapons or as destructive methodologies for other purposes. In other words, to try to separate what you can do and what you can accomplish. If you try to ban them all together, no, I'm not going to support that. I can't support that. I wasn't surprised when I went to Washington that when I had a shotgun for to would be available with me, and I registered it like I'm supposed to mm-hmm. in D.C. So that if I was going to go hunting from Washington, I would have a gun that I could use to go hunt. It was a shotgun. I don't have automatic or semi-automatic weapons at all. Don't plan to have. Automatic weapons are one thing, but I don't have semi-automatic weapons. I just don't think people are willing to give up something unless you identify that having them give up what they're giving up is going to solve the problem. And there is no solution that's been offered that has or promises to solve the gun problem. There are guns here, and there are going to be guns here, and what we have to do is, I think, identify those people who are most likely or have misused the weapons. You can try to push it over to other dangerous weapons like knives and so forth. They're different, but the arguments in many respects are similar.
Well, I will say, and I agree with this, that I grew up around guns, and we never had any mass shootings. We never, I remember there was, and we're approximately the same age, you're a little older than I am, but I remember the one shooting at the college in Texas where the guy was up in the bell tower, but that was
Whitman.
His
name was Whitman, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the one instance I remember as a young mm-hmm. person. And now mm-hmm. we have them every day, and it's crazy. And we do have to realize that, right? We have to step up to the plate and say, there's something else going on besides, it's not just the guns. There's something else going on, and we have to address that. And I agree with that. I was the son of a World War II veteran, as most of my friends were either Korean veterans or World War II veterans as fathers, and we all had access to guns. None of us ever thought about going down to high school and killing everybody because some girl wouldn't go to the prom with us or whatever, whatever the instance was. So, yes, I agree with you there, Senator.
I would take my shotgun and have it in my car in the school parking lot, so that it'd be available if we were going to go do a little road hunting legally, the way you can do it, and after school. Never thought a thing about it. I wouldn't have, nobody thought anything about it. We had no school shootings or anything of that sort. But things have changed. But I think you can get most people to agree that being able to identify those who are most likely to misuse guns because of their mental health, because of their backgrounds and so forth, you can keep them from being in their hands. And also, I think there's going to be maybe something that comes from the most recent case of parents now being sent to prison for not managing the guns with their children. That's another area that I think can be self-enforcing to parents thinking about theirs. I have two sons who have guns, and they both have gun safes, and they have sons as well, but they have gun safes.
Yeah. Well, and you know that I don't know all the answers, but I'm pretty sure, you know, I remember watching TV when I grew up, and Roy Rogers always shot him in the hand. And now I turn on a movie and 35 people get killed in the first 7 seconds of the movie. I mean, we're obviously sending out the wrong images, but there are other things as well. You're right, mental illness and other things. But let me move on and say my point in talking about this is how do we reach compromise? You have a reputation for being able to reach out and bring people together around an issue. We don't seem to be able to do that in Washington, D.C. And part of it these days in Congress, and part of it is that we have, in my opinion, a party that's in total disarray. We just had Marjorie Taylor Greene try to get rid of the speaker, right, the second time. Tip O'Neill was a speaker so long, I thought he was the speaker for life. But, these guys, they don't seem the least bit together. But is it more than that? What do you think's going on? Is there any way we can bring people together? It seemed to me, and this bothered me more than anything, that when they came up with the bipartisan border bill, and Donald Trump said, kill it, and they killed it. I thought, oh, my God, where do we go from here? Is there anything we can do to bring people together?
Well, probably it's going to be very, very difficult to be able to do that, because even yesterday, although Marjorie Taylor Greene brought Republicans and Democrats to vote together preserve the speakership, as a group, they decided to do that. That it was far better to be partisans. Now I think the pressure came to do it because the consequences of not doing it were far worse. So I wouldn't want to extol the virtues of bipartisanship there so much as to say that it shows that it is possible. Now, how can we do it in the other areas? The first thing that you have to have is you have to have people of goodwill who trust one another to put together a proposal. Now, that's what really happened with respect to the border issue on the southern border with Mexico.
Is this a big issue in Nebraska?
With some solutions. So they know how to do it. But there are those who are willing to go to almost any length to keep it from happening. In other words, it's convincing enough people to get something accomplished that is the real challenge. And that's going to have to require from people back home sending folks to Washington who promise to try to find solutions. Right now, with some of the members of the House in particular, and some from the Senate as well, they promise not to support the president whoever the president is, if it's the president of the other party. As opposed to, I remember pledging to the people in Nebraska when George W. Bush was on the ballot with me. We'd been governors together and somebody I knew, and I'll support whoever the president is, whether it's Bush or Gore. But I'm not going to obstruct. I'll look for solutions to find answers to the problems. And you have people coming to Washington who promise to do that and are held accountable to do that, because you've got people from back home, unfortunately, sending people who are just the opposite of the ones who need to go to Washington, if in fact you want somebody to work across the aisle to get something accomplished for the good of the country.
Well, you know, the fact that you brought that up, that was in the Washington Post today, that you know, they were talking about Republican members who of Congress, many of whom said they won't accept the results of the, not necessarily accept the results of the election. That's just outrageous. But, and let me ask you, do we need term limits? Do you think that's a solution to sending the same people over and over again?
Well, Nebraska didn't have term limits until not long ago. And the people in Nebraska voted to impose term limits. At the time, I thought it might be a good idea, but I've seen it in Nebraska not necessarily being a good idea. When I got to the governorship, there were some senators who had been in the Senate for a decade or more, and they were the keeper of what was good about the Senate, and they knew what needed to be excluded, so because it wasn't for the good of the Senate, it wasn't going to be good for the people. It's a little bit like coming to the U.S. Senate and meeting Senator Byrd, Robert Byrd from West Virginia. If you wanted to have somebody who loved the Senate, revered the very nature of the Senate and the rules of the Senate, he was number one. And so having the people who have the experience is a tremendous advantage for others who respect and support doing things that are consistent for the good of the country, and not falling into the pits of doing things that are just bad for the country. But it takes a little while to learn the ropes in order to know that. Yes. So I don't think term limits would be the answer to any of this. I think it has to become a respect for the rights of the minority interests within the country that are reflected in the nature of the House or the Senate, so that you come together and respect the rights of both sides on particular issues. That's why I think it was a mistake to have gotten rid of the filibuster for judicial nominees. I worked, I got together with others, a gang of 14, to avoid the nuclear option back when I was in the Senate, because I did. The fact that the filibuster and vote for cloture was being overused and misused was not a reason to get rid of the filibuster, but to find a way to modify the rules so that there was there to protect. I was asked that question. Well, you're going to agree to support all judicial nominees? I said, well, I'm going to agree to not require cloture votes, a supermajority vote for all the members of the nominees for judgeships. But I'm going to retain in our rule, our agreement that we reached. I said, so that I can vote for against cloture if there's a nominee that drains all the blood from my head. I won't be able to move forward. I want to reserve the right to require, in certain cases, a supermajority vote on a particular nominee. And I think that would be true of cabinet positions and other positions that have to be nominated and voted on by the Senate.
And that's because it does respect the minority position, right? I mean, that's exactly why you want to do it. Well, let me ask you, I mean, the thing about the bipartisan border bill, the thing that was most disturbing about that is that ex-President Trump asked the senators to do that. Have you, in your experience of senator, seen anybody that had so much control over the members of their party? I mean, I don't remember, you know, Will Rogers said about us that I belong to no organized political movement, right? I'm a Democrat. And that's really kind of we all relate to that. But I don't ever remember. I worked for three chairmen when I was at the Democratic National Committee. And I don't ever remember anybody in the Democratic Party having the kind of control that this man has.
No, I don't. You know, I suppose there are days when a speaker or a majority leader in the Senate might really like to have total control. But no. I've never seen anything like it, and particularly from somebody who's from the outside. But, you know, the thing of it is, I believed that Trump was going to get the nomination back when he attacked John McCain, and initially some of the veterans groups came to his defense, and then they trailed off, and then Trump doubled down, and then he said, I think if it was Fiorina, said, look at that face, and I thought, well, that's going to bring the women out against him, and that didn't.
Yeah.
I saw time and time again that this was a new style of politics at a higher level. And I knew I bet some of my friends that he would not only get the nomination, but then I saw that he would win, because it was a new style of politics in your face, power player, power politics. And there was an interest in that. Maybe it was not so much an interest in supporting it, but at least some fascination with that. We've not seen anything like that before during my lifetime, at least I hadn't, and I didn't know anybody else that felt like they'd seen anything like that. And it worked. It worked not just for that reason, but it survived the election, and naturally he got elected. I think people wore people down in the 4 years, and the real fear that I have right now is with that power coming back, doubling down, and for ignoring the rights of the minority side of issues, can win again. That people have forgotten how worn down they felt at the end of his first term.
Well, you know, I mean, I help train people that want to run for political office, and like you say, he violated every rule that we teach potential candidates. Mm-hmm. Don't annoy women. Right? There's more women voters than men voters. Don't attack the press. Don't attack the press, right? And that's all he does. I mean, it's just amazing to me. But let me ask you, go ahead.
He set new norms. He set new norms of conduct that, unfortunately, a lot of people still like in your face politics, in your face government.
Well, let me ask you about some of the particular hurdles that I think we need to get over as Democrats to win in November. You were on the Agriculture Committee. You come from an agriculture state. We know that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 248 points today, but people don't care. The average person doesn't care, right? It's bread and gas, right? Those are the things. That's how we judge how the economy's going, whether you got a job, whether you put gas in your car and food on the table, right? So what do you think about food prices? They seem really, really high right now. Do you have any insight on where we're going with that? Has it been supply? You know, we hear that supply chain was a problem during the pandemic. And, you know, can you think we can see food prices coming down anytime in the near future? Do you have any insight into that?
Well, you know, I don't think so. I mean, I would hope so. I shop at the grocery store, and I've seen the increasing prices over a short period of time, as well as over a longer period of time. I remember back, I guess it would have been during the Carter years. I'm not attacking all grocery stores or the grocery store industry, but it seemed that was about the time that there was less marking on products, the prices, and more just on the shelves, the prices, because people would take home a product and compare it to the price that they had bought 6 months ago or maybe 2 years ago or something like that, and see the different, how high the new price was. So one of the ways that I thought was unique was just don't put the prices on the product. Don't put a sticker price on a product. Just have it on the shelves. And if you take a look today at grocery stores, that's what you'll see most of. So people have to look a little more closely to examine price differential over point A to point B.
Well, yeah. And
but they know what's going up. They know what's going up. They feel it. They feel it in the bill, and they do see it.
Sure. Those of us, you know, I mean, I grew up as a working class kid, and I grew up in a family that lived paycheck to paycheck. So, you know, that's where you feel it, right? You feel it that you're not quite making it to the end of the week anymore. You're not quite, you know, you want to give your family a nice steak, but, you know, you're eating chicken a lot more than you used to and things like that, right? You feel it.
Sure.
And everybody feels it. I remember one of the great experiences of my life as a student was that I covered PL 480 when I was in graduate school and the Farm Bill. And it was just it was amazing to me that I had no sense of how the agriculture industry in America worked. It's very, very, very complex. But let me also ask you, I have another question for you, because you were on the Senate Armed Services Committee as well. And, you know, I had a brother. We were a working class family, and my parents died when we were kids, and we kind of raised ourselves. And I had a brother that worked his way through college and went into the Air Force. And in the Air Force, he went from having a bachelor's degree to having a doctorate from Vanderbilt, which the Air Force paid for. He was trained as an F-111 pilot, retired as a major, and became the president of a college. Now, it was a great opportunity for him. The service provided for him more opportunity than I think he would have found anywhere else. He graduated from college in the middle of the Vietnam War. And there weren't a lot of people enlisting in those days. But let me ask you, you think those opportunities are still there for servicemen? Are we still recruiting people like we used to? Is the military still a good place to grow and have a better life?
Oh, I think it is. I spent some time yet dealing with military personnel and former military personnel, most recently retired generals and the like. And I don't think it's changed to the point where it doesn't offer opportunities to people, young people at the college age. I think things have changed in terms of recruiting and the like. But I remember when I was elected to the Senate, shortly afterwards, I jumped out of an airplane in a tandem jump to bolster ROTC and signing up for the Army. And so the recruiting today is different than it was in those days. You know, Vietnam was a war that we were in. The wars we have today are wars that we are in promoting one side against another side in certain instances. But I think recruiting has to be different today than it was before. But I still think it's a good place for somebody to go.
Well,
not for everybody, maybe not for everybody, but a good place for young people to go, particularly some that are need to learn the importance and the power of self-discipline. That there probably isn't a better place for them to go than to the military to grow up. That's one of the things that I think has hurt us with our young people that have taken up the wrong directions on the streets. Back when you had the draft, and I'm not advocating the draft, I'm just pointing out what the draft did. It took an awful lot of people, young people, off the streets and put them into a disciplinary environment where when they came back from the military, they had their own discipline, and they were able to enter into the society and be able to have jobs and be able to have families and to live a different kind of life than they might have if they'd have stayed on the streets.
Yeah, I have a friend, a dear friend, who's now a retired medical doctor, who's a perfect example of that. Went in the Army, you know, had all sorts of problems when we were growing up, abused drugs and did other stuff. Straightened himself out, put himself through Columbia University and UVA Medical School, and became a doctor. So, exactly what you said. I've seen that happen on a personal level. But let me also ask you, since you were also, and by the way, let me commend you for your bravery, because the bravest thing I've ever done in pursuit of politics is I once sat in a dunk tank at a charity event, but I have never jumped out of an airplane. So congratulations on being that brave. But let me also ask you, because you are also on the Appropriations Committee. You've done it all. I had to actually think about whether to call you senator or governor, because you've done so much. But how do you feel about the economy? Do you have any sense of it? Does the Fed need to raise interest rates even more to try to control inflation? Or do you think we're on the right track and the country's on the mend?
Well, I think our economy is structurally better than we think it is. And it's a lot better than the people who think it's bad. It's a lot better than they think it is. Can it be better? Yes. Will it be better by raising or lowering taxes? That's a tough one, and I rely on and Janet Yellen and the others that deal with this on a day-to-day basis, because it is a very challenging question to try to answer, because you can't have whoops in a day or two. You're going to have to go through with it for a while if you make that decision to lower the rate. I think most people would like to see the rate dropped for the housing market. The rate is just so high today that it adversely affects the buyers and the number of homes being available because it's hard to be able to swing buying homes at the price that they are today. Now, to answer the question, I think that they're going to continue to look at this. I'm not going to be surprised, and I don't think it'll relate to the fact that they're doing it just before an election. But I'm not going to be surprised if they decide that maybe they do need to loosen up something on that rate. I don't know how you... I wish I had the crystal ball on what you do to absolutely corral inflation. I would like to put a stake through its heart and slow things down for a while and live with where we are and not see the inflationary spiral that we've gone through. I think it's better than it was, but it's not as good as people want. And the president and all the folks who are working with what to do with the rate inflation, I wish them the best, because you only find out after you've tried to do something whether it's going to work or not.
Well, that's become my mantra as an old person. The older I get, you know, that's I've learned that I only know whether I can do it anymore if I try it and it works.
That's true. See if it works. Yeah.
Yeah. But let me ask you, you know, one of the things that bothers me most is I think about John F. Kennedy and ask not what your country can do for you, mm-hmm. but what you can, and how we've gone from that to I am your retribution, which I actually don't think is a campaign slogan. I think it's a threat. But do we need to ask the American people to do more like Kennedy did? Or how about having fireside chats where should the president talk to Americans more and try to engender a spirit in them where we all work together again? You think that would be an important thing to do? Because it seems like we're all at different purposes.
I don't think it would make it worse. Yeah. In other words, don't think there's a downside. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what my grandmother used to say about praying, right? She used to say, can't hurt anything.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. No, I hope not.
Yeah.
So I don't think so. And I do believe that the John Kennedy Ask Not speech, I don't think it goes right over people's heads. I think they haven't put it to work in their own way. Mm-hmm. In other words, what can I do to make this country better? What can I do as opposed to asking, continuing to ask what the country can do for me? You know, I used to ask about issues when I was governor, in the Senate too. I'd ask the question, how does that impact my mother, seniors? How does it impact my family? How does it impact my neighbors? How does it impact my community, my state, and my country? And if I didn't get a pretty positive answer for every one of those questions, I would decide that's probably not very good. That's probably not going to be best. It's not going to be best for the country for any one of the reasons it wasn't good for somebody along the way. Not everything's always going to be good for everybody. I'm sure that's the case. But if you're not asking that question so you know who's going to benefit most from it and will they benefit for a longer period of time and at what cost to anybody else, you know, it's It's a tough one, but it's something that has to be addressed that way. And I think that's a little bit of what John Kennedy was saying. Don't ask what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for the country. Because if it's not good for the country, how does it end up being good for you?
Well, I think that really is a brilliant approach. And because that's where we all come together, right? We all care mm-hmm. about our we all care about our children. We all care about our family. We all care about our neighbors. And I think that's a really, really great way to look at it. Now, let me ask you, we're running out of time here, Senator. Is there something that you want to talk about that I haven't asked you about?
Well, you know, I don't think so. I think you've hit all the essential points that are out there of interest to virtually every American and everybody else watching us so closely as they are today, to see how we react, how we behave, and will we remain will we just simply remain a democratic republic? I mean, that's the question. Will we turn into a theocracy? Will we turn into an autocracy? I think that's what this is almost like the gathering in Philadelphia at the Constitutional Hall when everybody was gathering to decide what our government was going to be. And a woman asked Dr. Franklin, "Well, tell us, what do we have? Is it a kingship or what is it?" And he said, "It's a republic if we can keep it.
Yeah. And that, isn't that the truth? And that's a great way to end. I've traveled through Europe and spoken at several international conferences, and that's what they all care about, Senator. Everybody over there. America is still that shining city on the hill, right? And we have to keep it that way.
And we may not be shining as brightly for others or for ourselves right now, because of the threats of a dictatorship, or the threats of dictator for a day, all the discussion that you hear going on now about who would be in the cabinet, and they would be loyalists and once getting in power, there wouldn't be another election. All the fears that we have, we don't want realized. And it's so important that we remember that on election day and beyond, that Dr. Franklin was right. The question was, can we keep it? Will next January 6, 2025, result in a peaceful transition of power, or what will it bring?
Well, that's a great way to end, from a great legislator, and thank you for your service to America, Senator. I know that we've never met, but I've known about you for years. I hope that our paths cross somewhere, so that I get the chance to meet you personally. But thank you so much for being on our show. And we leave every show with a song that we dedicate to our guest. And here's a song from an old friend of mine named Nils Lofgren. It's called We All Sung Together, about bringing people together, as you did so many times on the Hill, Senator. So thank you. And let's hope we can do that, folks. Let's hope we can remember how to sing all sing together. Thanks, Ben Nelson. Have a great
Thank you, Senator. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
invitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.